This is Dr. Marvin Dunn, and I am the Storyteller. Our topic today, the Civil Rights Movement in Miami, with support from my brother, Dr. Raymond Dunn, and technical assistance from my nephew, Raymond Dunn Jr.
Thanks a lot, bro, for that intro. And bro, I'm really anxious to get started with this conversation. This is home, Miami.
Yes, so, indeed.
So, bro, the Sunshine State, good weather, vacations, beaches. Why will we need to have a civil rights movement in Miami?
Because the very same things that were wrong in Mississippi, Alabama, South Carolina, Georgia, were wrong in Florida. You could not have lunch at a lunch counter downtown. You had to sit on the back of buses. There were restrictions on voting. If you were a black person, you couldn't register as a Democrat. There were all kinds of insults that the civil rights movement tried to address. And Miami's emergence as the Sunshine State and attracting tourists and all of that was a part of the plan to dismantle or dismiss a lot of the civil rights activity that had to take place in Miami and in other cities in Florida.
So the leadership tried to whitewash our problems.
There was no eagerness to deal with racial issues in Florida, as Florida was trying to attract Northerners, investors like Disney World to come into Florida. The attempt was to have Florida not appear to be a racist southern state. And Florida had some of the same problems that the other southern states did as well.
Well, obviously, we got to the point where it had to be dealt with. So what was the first civil rights activity in Florida?
Well, actually, the civil rights movement, in a way, began in Florida.
Oh, okay.
The long and the short of it is that the end of World War II, when Dade County had allowed the Navy to use Virginia Key to train black recruits, because they were not allowed to go to the white county beach, Crandon Park. When the war was over, the county took the beach back from the Navy. Local blacks wanted to have that beach become a black beach. And so they approached the county and asked them for permission for the beach to become a Negro beach, and the county said no. So what happened was a group of black leaders got together and held a wade-in. Now, this is 1945, at a white beach, county-owned beach, called Haulover Beach in North Miami.
I remember Haulover, yeah.
And after that demonstration, the first civil rights demonstration of which I'm aware in Florida, the county agreed to have Virginia Key become a Negro beach. And this was, again, 1945, long before there was any organized civil rights activities elsewhere. The other reason I would say the movement began in Miami is because CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality, had its first training session for teaching people how to do nonviolent resistance. Mm-hmm. And that happened in Miami in 1959, again, before the movement took flight in other parts of the South.
Now, who were some of the participants in that? I know you know John Dew and Pat. Tell us about that.
Well, John Dew was not there. At this point, John Dew became a civil rights leader here in Miami later on. That time was not married to Pat Dew. Mm-hmm. But Patricia Stevens, as her maiden name, was one of the attendees at that meeting.
We're at the Civil Rights Movement in Miami. Who were some of the leaders?
Well, there were a number of them. I think the most influential one of the black civil rights leaders in Miami was Father Theodore Gibson, who was the head of Christ Church in Coconut Grove. Gibson was a very, very pivotal figure because he had a large congregation in Coconut Grove that assisted him, supported him in the things that he was trying to accomplish. You also have to give credit to some of the ones who worked with him. G.E. Graves, for example, black attorney who is not given nearly enough credit, but Attorney Graves represented the civil rights protesters who were arrested in the course of civil rights demonstrations in Miami. Mm-hmm. So Graves was an unsung hero working with Gibson and others towards civil rights. A major figure in the movement was Dr. John O'Brien. Mm-hmm. Now, Gibson became head of the Miami chapter of the NAACP.
Right.
Dr. John O'Brien, who was an ophthalmologist who came here from Oklahoma, World War II veteran, a doctor, headed the Miami chapter of CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality, and they were the most activists of the civil rights organizations. So John Brown was a major figure because he was out there in the streets. While the NAACP focused more on court actions, Dr. Brown was among the leaders who were doing active work in the streets. You also have to give credit to Edward T. Graham, who was a minister at that time of one of the major churches in Black Miami, who joined with Gibson in the NAACP activities and other things. So Alpha Lee Range. Now, Range, Mrs. Range, was not necessarily a civil rights leader. She came up a little later on, but she was the first black person to be elected to the Miami City Commission.
All right.
And was a very, very influential figure in Liberty City in the 1950s and 60s. So you have these leaders and others who coalesced to work towards advancing civil rights in Miami.
Now, boy, in many cities across this country, we had the black leaders doing their thing. We appreciate that. But in many cities, there were white leaders who came in to help. Did that happen in Miami?
There were white people who came to the assistance of the movement in Miami. They're not given nearly enough credit for that. Mm-hmm. Howard Dixon, for example, was a white attorney who also represented people who were arrested during the movement here in Miami. Jack Gordon, who later became a very powerful member of the Florida Senate, stood up and helped blacks. Leonard Terkel and his wife were very active in the civil rights movement. Herbert and Marilyn Bloom, the list goes on.
Right.
As a matter of fact, Dr. Brown told me, and he was in a position to know, he told me that had it not been for white participants in the movement, providing legal support and financial support and what have you, that there would not have been a civil rights movement in Miami.
That's probably very true.
Brown told me that you couldn't get black school teachers to join the NAACP. You couldn't get black professional people to join the NAACP. They were afraid. So Dr. Brown said that the folks in Miami who really carried the movement forward were the custodians, the bus drivers, the folks who did basic work in the community, not professionals.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the contributions came from, and of course from white people who supported financially as well as in some other ways too.
Okay, so we had the civil rights movement in Miami, all the leaders. What were some of the positive outcomes of that?
Well, let's talk about the areas in which they were active.
Okay.
For example, one of the things that they attempted to do was to force the desegregation of lunch counters downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And that required organized demonstrations, getting people together to go downtown and demonstrate. It involved rallying around some of the churches and the pastors who were able to get the congregations involved. So lunch counter sit-ins were among the activities. Father Gibson and Graves and others challenged the requirement that blacks had to ride on the back of the buses by going down and violating that standing rule, as it were, forcing the integration of parks. At one time, up until the civil rights movement, blacks could not go to public parks, could not use public facilities like swimming pools, beaches, and what have you. So all of these were restrictions that were placed on blacks.
Okay, bro, we had some positive outcomes from the civil rights movements in Miami, but one of the things that hopefully they accomplished was something to improve our rights to vote, our access to voting. What happened with that?
Well, up until the mid to late 1940s, blacks were not allowed to join the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party controlled the South, including Florida. So until a case was brought in Texas, the Allwright case called, which changed that and forced the Democratic Party to accept blacks, blacks were essentially impotent in terms of their voting. It took organized efforts inside Dade County in Miami once the Allwright case was decided and the Democratic Party was forced to accept blacks. Then political organization had to take place here in Miami. For example, one of the first things that happened was that we had an outfit called Operation Big Vote. This was headed by a guy called
Charlie Hadley.
Charlie Hadley, exactly. A legend in Miami politics.
He was.
He was one of the early political activists who was able to rally a lot of other black folks around him and then deliver the black vote to particular candidates. And up until the early 60s, late 50s anyway, white candidates didn't even go to Liberty City or to black communities to campaign. So Operation Big Vote was for a while a very effective tool in rallying blacks to support issues and candidates. And of course, you also had blacks moving into the Democratic Party machinery itself.
Right. Now, I know there were things to discourage blacks from voting. What was this whole thing about the burning of the dummy? What happened with that? That Overtown, that, I think.
Yeah, that, there was an election in 1939. The city of Miami
That was earlier.
1939.
Okay.
Yes. The city of Miami had a very hotly contested political race in the city. And the Klan, it rode into Overtown and posted dummies that were hung on lampposts. And they put a sign around the dummy's neck saying, "This nigga voted." Direct attempts to intimidate blacks in that hotly contested election. Problem was, it backfired.
What happened?
Well, the Miami Herald and some white leaders were insulted by the audacity of this. And so the black vote was the highest that it had ever been up to that point in terms of turnout. So it did backfire.
Well, Brooke, let me ask you one other question that might bring some closure to this part of our discussion. What were some of the fruits of the labor of all these people who participated in this and put their lives at risk and careers at risk? What happened? What outcomes?
Well, one outcome was that blacks were elected to public office. For example, Jolang Kershaw.
I remember Joe, yeah.
Jolang Kershaw was a social studies teacher in the Dade County school system, and he was the first black person to be elected to the Florida House of Representatives since Reconstruction. Gwendolyn Soy Cherry, who was the daughter of a very prominent early black physician in Miami, Dr. William Sawyer. Gwen Cherry became the first black woman to be elected to the Florida legislature.
Many of our listeners may recognize the name Cherry Park in Liberty City, I believe it is.
Indeed.
Who else?
Gwen Cherry, incidentally, was succeeded by Carrie Meek.
Exactly.
Gwen lost her life in an automobile accident on the campus of FSU, and Meek became the person who took over that legacy and carried it forward. You had at this moment blacks moving into positions of leadership. For example, when we move into the 1980s, we have blacks who are now in senior roles in the police departments. All of this came about as a result of civil rights activities. Now, mind you, whether or not you got to sit at a lunch counter downtown and eat next to a white person was window dressing. That was not really the essence of the movement. What was important about the civil rights movement is that it brought blacks together politically and made a progress in economic, political, and social areas are more expeditious because of the movement, not necessarily the social necessities or niceties, rather, of eating in the same room with a white person.
You don't necessarily want to sit next to a white person. You just want to know that if you care to eat, you can sit there.
Exactly. And that was the whole point of the lunch counter demonstrations. You know, before those people did that, if you were a black person and you went downtown, they would serve you in the department store. Well, let me not be incorrect about that. If you were to go to a white establishment that served food, you had to take it out, or they would have a place for you in the back.
Yeah, you served from the back window.
Exactly. So that was the kind of insult that people felt had to be changed. But my point is, there were far more important accomplishments in terms of economic and political progress than just the social courtesies of being able to eat the same restaurant with a white person.
Bro, I said I was going to close this episode out with that question, but I just can't. I've got one more I've got to put in there.
Sure.
Were any of the governors of Florida of any help?
Well, yeah, there were two moderate governors came along. Leroy Collins, who was really a moderate. But mind you, Collins ran for office for governor on the platform that he supported segregation and that he would use the powers of the governor's office to prevent it when he could. Turns out he was much more compliant to the movement than he was when he was a candidate. So Collins helped set a mood in Florida that was more receptive to the changes that were going on in the South. But beyond him, Reuben Askew, in my view, was the most liberal and supportive governor in terms of black rights that we have ever had before or since.
Bruh, I appreciate it. You took us from the early civil rights movement in the city of Miami, as a matter of fact, in the state of Florida, all the way up to the governor's office. We will have another episode that will follow up some additional civil rights activity in other cities in Florida.
And we're also going to do a program on the desegregation of schools in the county.
Yes, I'm very anxious to talk to you about that.
Okay.
But for now, that's a wrap. We thank you for listening to The Storyteller, a production of MR2D Media. This and other stories are available at donehistory.com, tbeunfiltered.com, or in print, Black Miami in the 20th Century by Dr. Marvin Dunn.